Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and with us today is Eric Hernandez. Eric is a senior vice president with Lee & Associates. He specializes in commercial real estate, and a subcategory would be industrial real estate is his exact specialty. He specializes in land sales and development, tenant buyer representation, landlord representation, and investment sales and analysis. Eric, welcome back. It's been a long time.
Bruce, good to hear from you. I think the last time we spoke, the market was a little different than it is today.
Yeah, we had talked prior to that happening, but I think we may have talked last in 09. So let's go back and talk about the peak of the market in the market you're most familiar with. What year was the peak, and what kind of inventory will we be talking about when we say, okay, the peak was, you know, whatever year it is? What exact part of the commercial world?
So we would say the peak of the market in our world was the summer fall of 2008. You know, when everything started to hit the fan. One of the best pieces of insights I ever heard about the real estate market was from a lender, financier, real expert when it comes to financing commercial real estate, and he said, property is worth what I can lend against it.
Okay.
So when the lenders disappear or their lending criteria changes, not unlike the residential side, you know, the industrial commercial side also saw a lot of money out there chasing deals. And when that started to go away, you know, a lot of appetites changed. And, you know, we're influenced by job creation or job loss, of course, because that affects our supply and demand. And, you know, if you go back and look at the jobs numbers in 2008 and 2009, you know, we had quarters where we were losing, you know, six, I think maybe even a quarter of, you know, low seven-figure job losses. I mean, it was pretty dramatic in such a short period of time.
In the peak of the market and before problems occurred, what would have been the motivation for the buyer to enter the market at that price point?
Well, in our market, we have several different classes of buyers, so maybe we ought to understand that a little bit. If you're and in our market, of course, we deal a lot with companies and investors that buy property, and then we also deal with companies that rent property. A lot of corporations or businesses, they strictly only rent property, so maybe we can think of that in both dynamics. On the investment buy side, both from an acquisition point for a company to invest to either occupy the building or to own it and collect the income on it, there was still a feeling of the ability for rents to rise. And if rents are rising and cash flow is good, that means that continued good returns are possible. You know, another aspect is we had, you know, 4 to 5 years running of significant annualized appreciation, and you know, people can look backwards and see maybe what they missed and feel like if they didn't get into the market, they were going to continue to miss out. And there was a lot of money that still entered the market even at that late stage in the game that wanted to be here in Southern California in particular.
I remember something we did talk about where, you know, real estate loans had their version of stated income, but what you guys had in the commercial side was projected rent increases.
We call that pro forma rents. That's okay. Right.
Which obviously didn't occur.
Well, that's right. I mean, when you underwrite a real estate transaction, you know, like anybody, your crystal ball can really only go out so far on time. And mine doesn't go out very far. I know you've got one that works for the cycles on the residential side, which is just magic. We're not unlike that on the commercial side. However, the rent growth that was projected, really, if you go back to 2008, that's when it peaked. So anybody that had underwritten or relied on future price appreciation or pro forma rent growth, you know, they were really left holding the bag.
And also, if they looked at what would be a normal vacancy rate, that probably didn't occur either.
That's right. That's right. So we worked with a couple of large tenants at that time, and it turned out that that was one of the best times, you know, late 2008 and 2009, to be a tenant in the market, because the landlords that were sitting on vacancy, especially some of these large companies that are publicly traded, you know, industrial real estate investment trusts that have quarterly reports they owe to Wall Street and they have investors analyzing them, they had a mandate to fill their vacancy no matter what. And what happened was, you know, the first few amazing deals that happened went down at prices that nobody thought they would step so low so fast to achieve. And, you know, the philosophy at that time was, well, do you want to be the first deal at that price, or do you want to be the 12th one at that price a year from now?
And, of course, since that's the direction, it usually is lower and lower and lower. But also connected to, you know, the declining rents really affect value in commercial real estate, correct?
Absolutely.
So that really changed the valuation almost overnight when you had so many vacancies that you were able to, even if you were an existing tenant, dictate a discount, you were devaluing the value of the property at almost, what, a year or two after. The lenders were probably more aggressive than they'd ever been in evaluation.
That's right. That's right. So it's actually double whammy, because you're looking at, you know, declining rents, declining appreciation. And the interesting thing that happened in our market was, our market is heavily driven by construction, and out here it's speculative construction. It is very much a, if you build it, they will come market.
Right.
And we've been the beneficiary of being in what we would call the greater Los Angeles basin. So we're the beneficiary of a lot of companies that want to be in Southern California, and they are just physically either priced out or cannot get what they need in terms of a state-of-the-art, say, large industrial building in LA. If they want to be in Southern California, they really have to be out here today. And so the big wave of construction that happened, you had a lot of construction loans that were placed against those properties, and you could not replace those construction loans with permanent financing at that time. And so what happened in the 90s was, you know, all those properties typically went back to the bank.
Right.
This time, you know, and as you may recall, the mandate of the FDIC during this crisis, and Sheila Bair, the head at the time, is they wanted to avoid a repeat of the 90s, where they did this massive liquidation, and then everybody that wound up buying properties through the RTC came out smelling like roses not more than 2 years later.
Yeah, and I think the residential problem actually set the table for being reasonable with commercial problems.
I think you're right. So this time around, you know, a lot of the lenders were not just banks, but life companies, pension funds, private equity, and a lot of what went on during this cycle was, you know, the old blend and extend, where you may not have typically seen loans get replaced, but this time they were written down. People may have contributed equity to the deal and were able to extend a loan for a period of time and essentially bought themselves enough time to get out of most projects that otherwise would have had major issues. And so it was a very different story this time around was in the 90s. Very different.
And I recall looking at a chart of not resets, but basically payoffs. So you look at a chart of commercial loans, and the last 2 years and the next 2 or 3 years have this gigantic number of billions of dollars of loans that have a due date.
That's right.
And if you look at that chart, you think, okay, well, this is going to be a historic number of foreclosures, and it just hasn't materialized unless it's, you know, in an isolated area, I guess.
It has not happened. So something that, say, the general public might not realize, but the specialists on the real estate side do is, and what you're referring to is this CMBS market, the commercial mortgage-backed securities market. And a lot of those resets are happening now over the next 2 years,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
And the way those deals are structured is they have, you know, a return on the notes that were underwritten for the property. However, those are guaranteed returns. You can't just call the bank or whoever holds the note at that point and say, hey, I want to pay this off. Because if you do, the prepayment penalty is massive.
Okay.
It's gargantuan. I mean, in some cases, it could be 20 to 30% of the outstanding principal.
Okay.
And so if you don't have to do that and the market is rising, then you're kind of waiting it out right now, hoping that the market continues to your advantage. And then next year or later this year, you may replace that debt when it comes due and callable with new, maybe conventional financing or some other type of financing, just depending on market conditions. And so I've got several clients who have shared that with me that, you know, although most people would think that, you know, the worst was behind us, that hopefully they'll be the beneficiaries of a still very accommodative lending environment that is actually becoming more accommodative right now, and they'll get the best of both worlds. They were able to hang on to a property that they maybe would have had issues with, and maybe even put better financing on it than they've got right now. And if your income stream is the same and you reduce your debt payments per month, your overall net cash flow actually goes up dramatically, right?
Right.
Not unlike a homeowner that was able to refi their home like I did, going from, you know, maybe 6% to below 4%.
I know in the residential world, lenders never make loans with the thought, okay, well, maybe we can get the assets someday. So what is it like on your side when a lender, like a life insurance company, makes a loan? I don't think they're ever after the asset, are they?
No, most of the time their interest is strictly on the return that they get, on the yield.
And the calmer, the better.
That's right. That's right.
They don't want the excitement of foreclosing and kicking tenants out or living with a bad lease, or they just want to get a check.
When this all started, most of the major institutions, they really didn't even have a fully staffed REO department or what we would call special assets. That's what kind of it became. And so they had to staff up for that. So everyone from the institutions, the lenders, the life companies, or whoever serviced their assets, and then a lot of the title companies, escrow title companies, you know, they had skeleton crews, if anybody, so they had to really staff up for that. And they've worked their way through most of that. In fact, you know, the FDIC location, you know, down in Irvine closed, I guess it's been about a year and a half ago now. And a lot of the REO departments have been consolidated from, you know, B of A on their commercial side. They consolidated a few people into one location where they'd had kind of people scattered around, and others have done the same because they didn't need that manpower anymore.
You know, when we talk about commercial real estate, it's this big umbrella. Let's talk specifically about office.
Sure.
And what was that one of the harder hit segments of commercial real estate?
It was. In fact, you could probably argue if it was office or retail that was the hardest hit out here in the Inland Empire.
Okay.
And in order of hardest hit, you know, office or retail, I would say probably retail. And then from there, you would go industrial, and then probably multifamily was the first to recover.
Yeah, because of everybody getting foreclosed on, there was a lot of new renters.
That's right. In fact, the multifamily market, you know, it hit the wall for a little bit, but that was really the first property class to really see new construction. And actually, I remember seeing apartments under construction out here as early as late 2009, I believe.
Yeah, that was good timing, because most of the time you're seeing construction now when it takes a while to get permits and all that and plans and everything. So what's interesting now is those people really probably want to be a homeowner again. So I'm not sure their vacancy rate is going to be as good as they think it is, but
yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that develops. But, you know, the housing market created instant renters, for the multifamily asset class. And also, you know, the government and lenders, that was probably the easiest asset class to get a loan for. So you had everything going for you. You had demand, and you had people willing to loan you the money to go out and buy the properties.
What segment of real estate is the most expensive to build if we're talking office, retail, or industrial?
Well, they all have their different aspects on what it requires to build, right? So a fully improved office building would be the most expensive.
Okay.
Especially if it was a multi-story building, something over three stories. You don't see a lot of that happening out here. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but you know, there's an office building under construction in downtown LA. Have you heard about this?
No.
And it's going to be the tallest building west of the Mississippi.
Okay.
And it's going to be like the Sears or now, you know, Willis Tower in Chicago, where you're going to have a deck. And I saw a rendering that actually had a pool on it. But it's one of the first major office buildings to get built in downtown LA in, you know, years and years and years. And it was a site that, of all people, Korean Airlines actually owned. And it's going to be a really impressive building when it's done.
In Riverside and San Bernardino County, does it pencil to build office yet, or is there still existing inventory far less than the cost to build?
It's almost there. There are some office projects that have been standing inventory for many years now. And the office brokers I talked to in my office have told me that, these last great deals that are still priced below replacement cost, you know, if they're not already gone, they'll be gone here before the end of the year. And that, along with demand, will start to spur new office construction. We're seeing some of that now, but it's more of a build-to-suit nature.
Okay.
And there's really no major speculative new office construction happening right now. But there's people starting to talk about that.
When you talked about the size of the building, if you had an REO that was, say, 4,000 square feet, or an REO that was 30,000 square feet, which is the easier one to fill with a tenant?
What was the size again, Bruce?
Say 30,000 to 4,000, or you pick the number. In other words, a smaller office and something that would take a bigger company. Which one of those is tougher to fill if you're going to look for a renter?
You know, on you're talking about the office side?
Yeah, the office stuff.
The office side, probably the larger footprint right now.
Okay.
I would, and really, you know, since my specialty is zeroed in on the industrial side, I'm speculating a little bit there. The smaller size range, you may get, a regional satellite office or somebody like that that's looking for space. The market has started to firm up. That's still in the startup size range. So if someone's out starting up a business, they could fill that. A 30,000 square foot office deal out here is a pretty large deal for this market.
On the industrial side, where do you see that market from the bottom to where we are now? What type of price increases have we had, and are we having rent increases and vacancy declines?
So the price increase off the bottom has been very dramatic, and we're actually looking at valuations now that, if the trend continues into next year, we'll be approaching peak valuations that we hit in the last cycle.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And there are a lot of people out there that think that this price wing still has a lot of momentum to go.
Now, why would that be true? Has income dramatically increased from the peak before?
So in our market out here, or any market, you know, we talk about valuations. And so real estate valuation has a metric that's not unlike, when you look at a stock and you look at the price to earnings ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have what's called a cap rate. And the cap rate is a percentage of return based on the first year's net operating income that an investor might look to acquire a property at. The higher the cap rate, typically if the rent is the same, the lower the price per square foot.
Correct. Okay.
So the cap rates out here, have continued to fall, and we're in an environment of rising rents. So you compound those two things together, and that has continued to push valuations higher.
So you could tell me in the same sentence that the value of the building in dollars is reaching its past peak, but we're not reaching the cap bottom.
Potentially, or the rent bottom, or ceiling. So, for example, let's say that cap rates today, I'll use a number of 5%.
Correct.
Okay. All things being equal, if the rent stays the same, you know, the valuation is the same, but if the rent continues to rise, even if the cap rate is fixed, the overall building valuation is going to continue to rise. And so even if the expected rates of return stay the same, or maybe even if that cap rate dipped up slightly, if the rents continue to grow at a 5 to 10% clip annually, you'll continue to see that rise in underlying asset value.
Nope.
So that's what's driving some of the money that's looking for deals in the market today.
What's interesting is we've gotten there without the help of the construction world. I mean, there's not a lot of homes being built. And does that affect industrial space, or is that what part of commercial real estate does that most impact?
It's probably a mix of office, but mostly industrial, because when you get into the industrial side, that's the supply chain for the home building side. So
yeah, you got the guy with the little office and the warehouse for all
the marble
stuff.
Guy, the granite guy, the tile guy, the flooring guy, the carpet guy, you know, the framers, the aluminum companies that supply the, you know, the window frames, if they're putting in aluminum windows, the window guy, and all the way down the food chain. There are so many different people involved in what it takes to build a home, you know, the lumber people and so on, all the construction people, that we're just seeing the first wave of companies looking to do things again. You're right. We haven't even had that follow through in that segment of the market that we're heavily influenced by out here.
Okay. Now, so we're getting, if we continue with the pace, a year from now, we're at the value peak. Has that been assisted by the same speculative type of financing?
Not yet.
Okay. You know, what's interesting is, and this is the one thing about predicting things, it's not just statistics, it's human nature. So commercial lenders or whoever is ultimately financing, you know, this, whether it be Wall Street and the willingness for people to take risk, we seem to repeat the same pattern. So I would expect as prices escalate, you would find more and more creativity in financing start to occur. Is that usually follow?
So you are right. There's a cycle that happens when everybody retreats. In the commercial side, there is, you have your basic lending institutions, and then you have what we would call mezzanine financing.
Okay.
So let's say I want to buy a piece of property and it's $100. The bank will lend me $70 on it.
Okay.
That means I've got to put $30 of my own money into it.
Right.
You know, when the market was really bad, maybe the lender would only give you $55.
Okay.
To buy it, right? Whereas now they'll give you $70. The difference is today I might go get some type of equity partner or preferred return private money guy, and he might loan me $25 to be in a second position so that I've only got to put $5 of my own money in the deal.
Okay.
Now, if my hold is maybe a 2 to 4 year hold, and he's going to get a preferred kind of guaranteed return if the project goes well, I only have to put $5 of my own money in it. But if the property is worth $150 a few years from now and I exit, then I look great because I deliver great returns for everybody. Everybody gets their money back, and I come out smelling like roses.
Eric, let's stop right there. We're going to have another segment with you. We've been talking with Eric Hernandez, the Senior Vice President with Lee & Associates. Eric, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.